This is high pressure in dealings of the way New Zealand works, the political system of New Zealand, and we're just a corporation now. We have no say in running of the country whatsoever. And New Zealanders are slaves to the system. And it's just no surprise. You just look at the names. And none of these people actually work for this country. You've only got to mention a referendum in this country. You know, you can have a referendum with 80% of the people saying, you know, we want change, and the government turns around and says, no, we don't have to do it. It's just a waste of time. We do what we're told.
We just don't have any choice in the matter, you know. I mean, they've corrupted everything. They've destroyed everything that used to define the country of itself. And I think basically the country's in this massive identity crisis where they don't even... Kiwis, born Kiwis today, don't know what it's like to be a Kiwi. They got no idea.
They have no idea.
No freaking clue. And I think once you detach a society away from their own sense of identity, then it leaves it open for somebody outside that society to control their destiny.
Absolutely. Once you've destroyed a community, which is what the system does, this is why you have amalgamation. This is why Auckland has amalgamated all the mayors. Because what you do is you take away Auckland's regional identity and you have one great big cesspool called Auckland. And it soaks up billions of dollars to make roads and casinos and tunnels. It doesn't do a thing for community and society whatsoever, but it is the focal point for making money. And in Taranaki here, they try to make out in the newspapers here that amalgamation of councils was great, and they were talking about doing that in Taranaki, amalgamating three different councils. And then you've got idiots appearing in the newspapers saying, oh, that... there's a lot of people saying, oh, it's a great thing, you know, you do this, you save a lot of money. Nothing could be further from the truth. If you amalgamate, you get rid of 90% of the people that have got any intelligence, and you place into power a very well-paid CEO and a well-paid mayor, and you completely control and have doctrine over an area of New Zealand. And this is what's been going on in this country. You amalgamate all the... milk manufacturers, you know, all the independent milk producers all get put under Fonterra. Fonterra is multi-billion dollar, and they can do anything they want. And there used to be rules about having monopolies, but the government threw that out the window. And this is what it's
what
about.
I call Fonterraism.
Yeah. Look at Air New Zealand. Air New Zealand decided it was bigger than its own boots and tried to take over Singapore Airlines. And somehow or other, they've never really explained it on television, but Air New Zealand managed to completely bankrupt itself. So New Zealand taxpayer had to buy its own airline to get it back on its feet again. And this is what the government does. I mean, look at the South Canterbury Finance. That goes bust. And the figure was, what was it? $1.6 billion of taxpayers' money goes into bailing out a private investment company. Why? Because there were an awful lot of people who had lost an awful lot of money in there that shouldn't have lost a lot of money, and they shouldn't have put their money in there in the first place. But
actually, you may have got the wrong end of the stick about that. I've interviewed Paul Carruthers, who was kind of like the guy who was standing in and speaking for Alan Hubbard during that whole debacle. What was his name? Who was Simon Power, I think, was the Justice Minister at the time. And you know who Michael Stiassny is?
No.
Quartermentha, they do all the big receiverships. So they did the receivership for the Crayford Farms, the receivership for basically any big receivership that's in the media gets done by this guy, who's incidentally a personal friend of John Key. And which bank does all the government's banking? Westpac Bank, isn't it?
Right.
And in order to shut down a company and put it into statutory management, you have to have evidence that it's actually losing money or it's out of control or they actually do something like that, which means there has to be an investigation. Now, how long do you think it would take for a government agency to do an investigation on a multi-billion dollar company like that?
Quite a long time.
How about a weekend?
That's not really feasible, is it?
Sounds kind of suspicious, doesn't it?
It does.
That sounds like somebody made a hell of a lot of money out of it, doesn't it?
$1.6 billion.
Yeah. And guess where all the assets were sold off to? Westpac Bank, who does all the government's banking again. And who, just after this incident, got a promotion, leaves the government, leaves his position, and then becomes the head of corporate banking for
Simon Power.
Simon Power. Justice Minister Simon Power. So, yeah, this was a big stinky one, and apparently the days before Alan Hubbard died, he'd said to the government, look, I've got enough evidence to say that John Key fudged this whole thing. Like, for example, you don't investigate a company just because the Prime Minister says they're dirty, right? You know, you actually have to do an investigation. There has to be evidence. None was actually gathered. In fact, the one of the main stated reasons why they did this, you know, thing was because somebody complained about not receiving a prospectus from one of the affiliate companies, a smaller finance company branches of South Canterbury Finance, which incidentally was totally private and didn't send any prospectuses.
It's quite a tangled web, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. And the fact that Alan Hubbard died a day or two before he was going to go to court to release his evidence about John Key being a corrupt scumbag is even the more suspicious.
Yeah, yeah. You've got to be really careful about conspiracy theories, I think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think what's quite sad about this whole situation is that, from my summation, the Alan Hubbard was probably one of the few honest businessman left in the country with any real power, and because he trusted the government when they came in, because he trusted all these lawyers and everything like that, which never defended him one iota when he was under full-on attack, right. They were able to basically pilfer and take all of the wealth that he created. And you know, everybody from young farmers to elderly couples that have their nest egg in there lost everything. And the government bailed everybody out and then sold all the proceeds to companies, which they wound up getting jobs in.
That was one of the surprising things that came out of the debacle at the time, was that there were so many people in Southland that were actually supporting Hubbard and saying what a decent guy he was. And yet at the same time, the government was turning around and saying, oh, well, you know, somehow or other there's been a lot of money lost. But the whole thing was getting very vague and shadowy. But the thing that I remember all the time was how many people were coming out in support of John Hubbard and saying, you know, he's a decent guy and he's always done the best thing for us. So somehow or other, it all fell to pieces. So, yeah, I hadn't known all those facts. But it makes sense.
And also the accident was quite suspicious. He wasn't travelling at any speed at all. At the time of the accident. In fact, Alan Hubbard and his wife had pulled over to the side of the road, and then they were hit by a car coming the other way in the wrong lane of traffic that was carrying a concrete mixer from Dunedin to Nelson and wasn't planning on laying any concrete.
All right.
And so Alan Hubbard went to Oamaru Hospital, where they said, oh, you're fine, you know, kind of thing. You know, you had a bit of a fractured pelvis or something like that, but otherwise he's good, you know, joking and laughing with the nurses. And then all of a sudden he's being wheeled out, and everybody's like, well, where's he going? They go, oh, we're taking him the Westpac helicopter to Dunedin Hospital, you know, it's an emergency. And they're like, oh, okay, bye, Alan, bye, you know. It's a 6-minute trip in the helicopter, and he didn't survive it.
Well, that's a rather horrendous suggestion, isn't it?
Hmm.
I wasn't aware of that. I thought he was actually severely injured in the crash and died from his injuries in the crash.
Yeah. Well, he wasn't injured enough to not make the nurses laugh.
Oh, well, that's something I didn't know at all. It's a bit like good old Princess Diana, right?
Oh, yeah. I interviewed the guy who wrote the book, The Diana Inquest. In fact, he's up to part 5.
I didn't know anything about that Alan Hubbard thing. I just, this is the problem, is that you get such small snippets of information sometimes out of the media, and it's so corrupt and so disjointed. You've got to do the digging to start finding the truth.
You know, it costs you something to find the truth. It always does. Nobody ever finds the truth for free. That's what I've found. If you want to know the truth, it's going to cost you something. It might cost you money. It might cost you your job. Or it might cost you your life. You know?
There's a problem in the world, is that you do get these mysterious deaths every now and then. I didn't realise Alan Hubbard was in there as well. That's a bit of a revelation. But then, what are you going to do in your life, eh? You just sit out your life doing twiddling your thumbs, saying, oh, well, it's not my fault, it's not my problem, I won't do anything about it. it's a pretty sick sort of a life if you do that. But unfortunately, an awful lot of people do that. And this is why we're in the trouble we're in around the world, is because too many people take that view.
Yeah, it's just learned helplessness at the end of the day. People think that they can't accomplish anything, so they don't even bloody try.
That's right. And if only they knew that they could actually move mountains if they wanted to, it's actually quite easy. But they don't. The apathy is just almost 100%.
Yeah, well, that and the fear. You know, it's either I don't care or I'm too afraid to bother.
That's right. Fear comes into it a lot. You see, one of the things I used to study and try and explain to myself is how do you get 5,000 Jews to march out into a field, dig a hole, their own grave, and then stand by the edge of it and wait for it to be shot?
Fluoride probably helps.
What was that? Fluoride?
Yeah.
You reckon it rots the brain?
Oh, well, it is the main ingredient in Prozac and rat poison.
Oh, right. No, it's a big thing. I mean,
And it does eat through glass and concrete, so, you know, it can't be that good for you.
No, well, yeah, that's right. I mean, it's one of those debates. Where was it just recently? Was it Hamilton that just decided that they were...
Oh, we took it out and then we're going to put it back in. Why did you take it out? Well, a couple of activists got access to our council. And 7 of the councillors out of 14 recused themselves from actually even listening to the fluoride thing because they're biased.
There was a court decision just recently when the judge said that he saw no argument. There was no argument to be made that fluoridation was mass health treatment of the masses, because he compared it to using chlorine in water to... sanitize the water, and he said that there's no argument to say that you can't use fluoride in the water. The fluoride is a very strong element, and the arguments for it, I think, are it gets into your teeth and it hardens up your teeth and all that. The trouble is you're drinking the damn stuff, and it's going into your system first, and liters and liters and hundreds of liters, and over the course of a year, it's thousands of liters. It's in your cooking when you boil your spuds and all this, so you're drinking vast quantities of fluoride. I don't know the full argument with fluoride, but I certainly wouldn't, if they fluoridated the water that I drink here, I would immediately stop drinking the stuff. I don't see the evidence that it stops the tooth decay. We have...
if anything, it exacerbates it with dental fluorosis.
Well, I think so, and we don't know the full long-term effects on bones and the body. I mean, fluoridation has been around for a long time, but it hasn't been around long enough to make long-term studies on it. And I think it would be a dangerous practice to start doing that and say, yes, it's good for you. The thing is that we have wonderful toothpaste and toothbrushes and dental hygiene all over the place, and it strikes me as a bit bizarre that we can't actually brush our teeth and look after our teeth that way, that we have to actually drink tons of this stuff and put it into our bodies.
Now, speaking of which, fluoride's a toxic chemical and you can't dump it into the environment. But if you sell the toxic chemical, then it becomes classified legally as a product, not toxic waste. You can't dump products into the human drinking water supply. But you can't dump toxic waste into it.
It is. It's
so what you've got to do is first you purchase your toxic waste, then you dump it.
Yep. It's a clever play on the legal side of things, isn't it?
And we're a bit of freaking Alice in Wonderland, you know.
But you see, if people actually were intelligent and educated, they would be able to make some very educated decisions on what is basically a very simple subject. But the trouble is they can't. And we have to go through this annual debate almost on these petty little things that should be sorted out. But we don't. But you see, this is all smokescreen and mirrors, isn't it? While you're debating fluoride, you're not looking at Iraq and the Ukraine and Syria and Libya and all the rest of it. You're not you're not looking at the real values and problems in the world. And some of them are absolutely horrendous, what's going on around the world. And we pride ourselves in New Zealand, or we used to, of being a Christian country, following Christian beliefs. Well, nothing can be further from the truth. In fact, Helen Clark, one of the things I put in my book was that Helen Clark actually declared once when she was our reigning boss that New Zealand was no longer a Christian country. And while she was actually referring to the statistics of the fact, it was interesting in the rather flat way she said it, that she couldn't give a shit whether this country had Christian values or not. And of course, if you're a dictator and you're looking at the corporate leadership of your country, why should you keep a ship? It doesn't matter. And that explains why when 500,000 New Zealanders leave this country, she also couldn't give a ship. And there was another interesting time in the latter years of her reign when we started off the year in this country in January with a monumental surge in murders. And there was something like two or three a week for the first few weeks. And one
have
of
you ever noticed it's never the politicians?
No, I know. I always wondered that.
I got an answer for you, actually. Hey, you know why none of the bad guys get assassinated?
Why is that?
Because only a good guy would want to get them assassinated, and good guys don't assassinate people.
That's it. That's basically the problem. What we need is some...
Yeah, good guys need to start assassinating people, you know.
And you don't have to shoot many. You've only got to shoot a dozen or two, and then the whole system will collapse.
Yeah, I mean, politicians and dictators and stuff like that, in order to kill good people, they kill millions of them and stuff like that. In order to kill bad people, it's just a few here, a few there, you know, boom, you know, problem solved, you're living in a gravy train.
I was talking to a Canadian a few years ago, and he actually came out with a very good quote. He said, do you know, if you got rid of government for a week, you could actually solve a lot of problems.
Well, the Queen still retains the power to dissolve Parliament. And I thought, man, that'd be a great power to have, you know, just dissolve them all, and sulfuric acid preferably.
I don't think that will actually work.
You reckon?
You've got to get these people to stand still, and they're too busy running around.
I don't know, just it's like a trap, you know, like in Jumanji or something, you know, you have some kind of a pit of acid, you know, cut over with leaves or something like that, and chase the politicians, you know, dress up in red communist outfits or something like that, and sing Viva la Revolution or some crap, and they would, like, run away from you going, ooh, I need to save my scumbaggery ass from revolutionaries, and then they, like, fall in the vat of acid, and it's just, you know, boom, our problems evaporate.
It's a nice thought. What's your opinion of our man in the late evening, Paul Henry?
I haven't listened to his new show, to be honest. I've since my radio broke in my car and the television aerials got switched over to digital, I haven't really paid any attention to mainstream media whatsoever.
Oh, well, you haven't missed anything. You haven't missed a thing.
I didn't think so.
No. I was just wondering what you thought about him after his dismissal from TVNZ and then his dismissal from Australia, and he comes back here and he has...
People still keep giving the motherfracker a job, though, because the people love him.
Yeah, well, I wonder about that, because you have to go by the statistics and the ratings and all this, which are all produced by the media and the government anyway, so the reality was that they were saying he was doing all right here, and then, of course, he wasn't, and they sent him over to Australia, and the Australians very quickly made their decision on him and sent him back. And, of course, we go and report in the newspaper here saying, oh, isn't it wonderful to have Paul Henry back in this country, his wit and enthusiasm and all this. And so you get all these idiot writers who write these idiot profiles in the newspaper, and, of course, there are people out there that actually believe it, but it is just a paid article that's just been put in there to convince people that Paul Henry is actually doing a good job. But again, that's all part of the propaganda and the brainwashing of this country.
Well, as we all know, biased in journalism sells more magazines.
That's right. It's truly astonishing, isn't it? Do you know, when I sent out my book on the corruption of the New Zealand Law Society, and I sent it off to John Campbell and 60 Minutes and 2020 and Fair Go and Listener Magazine, and even sent it off to North and South and what's his name, Ian Wishart. And none of them got back to me. Not a single one of them. Mm. So it was interesting.
Yeah, well, I can understand Ian not doing that because he's always he's always exposing scumbaggery and that, and he's probably working on his new books. He's working on a book like a year or something like that, sometimes even two.
Oh, yeah. But see, where's his credibility these days?
Ian Wishart's credibility?
Yep.
Well, he just released this new book, Totalitaria, which actually outlines the entire apparatus of the New World Order and how it's corrupting the media, government, and business interests in order to act together in collusion whilst having their own motivations, kind of like a shark attack, you know?
Yeah, I know. But don't you think we've got hundreds of books like that all over the world and nobody pays attention to any of them, so why write another book?
Well, I don't think anybody from New Zealand's written one like that yet, eh? You never know. It might just be the ticket.
I don't think so. I think it'll just be another book.
Well, they did get on Coast to Coast AM as a result of it, with 29 million listeners.
Yeah, and then what was the result of that? Have we changed the system? Are we? Do we still have MMP? Is John Key still a manipulating financier?
Well, when you judge success, there's an awful lot of things that you've got to take into account. For example, how exactly do you measure the success? Do you measure the success by the amount of sales of the book? For example, one person bought 10 copies off of him just so he could hand them out because he thought it was so good. I'd say that's a pretty awesome book if somebody would do that.
Well, okay, so you've sold a few books, but...
Right, and then there's one measure.
Ultimately, the goal is to change the system and to make people wake up, and what has it done? Has it actually done anything?
Can you measure the response? I mean, how many people have read the book? Do we know the numbers on that? No. How many people have taken action in their own life as a result of reading the book? Can we have a look at the stats on that? No, because these kind of things aren't taking into account the fact that it's almost unpredictable, right? Like one kid today who's, I don't know, like 14 years old or something like that steals Totalitaria off his dad's mantelpiece and reads it. And then in 10 years' time, or something like that, he winds up starting a new political party to expose the scumbaggery of the New World Order or something, you know? Like, the ripples are small at first, but you just watch how they grow. You never know. It's better than not doing anything.
No, I agree wholeheartedly with you there. You have to watch the ripples grow, and as you say, if you don't do anything, then nothing will be done. But there are a prolific amount of books like that on the market in the system, and... Yeah, maybe I'm sort of flogging a dead horse in saying it's going to have no effect, because as you say, you know, you throw a stone in a pond and the ripples will spread. And I know that for a fact with the books that I've produced, because although nobody would talk to me about it, if you look at the media reports and certain aspects of the legal system, the political system, it has had an effect, but they just won't admit it. But there were changes. For example, I made a comment in the book I produced last year called A Dialogue of Madness, and it's all about New Zealand politics and 9/11 and corruption and the lies of the government. I made a comment in there that the New Zealand Law Commission was looking to amalgamate the two facets of media complaints authorities, and I can't remember the names of them now, but there were two of them. One was for audio and one was for visual. And Mary Major, who is a CEO of the system, she made a comment that she didn't want amalgamation, she wanted to keep the two separate. And her comment was that once you have scrambled eggs, you can't go back to yolks and whites. And I thought that was quite an outspoken argument, a good criticism. So I used it in the book, and I pointed out to the readers of the book that the New Zealand Law Commission quite actively shies away from the fact that it doesn't find any problem with the fact that we have two systems governing law practitioner conduct. And one is the courts, and one is the New Zealand Law Society's own system of disciplinary action, which is designed specifically to look after lawyers. So I wrote that in the book, and then I sent off several hundred copies around the country. And would you believe it, a few weeks later in our local paper, there was an article there that the Law Commission had abandoned its its ideas of merging the media complaints authorities. They were going to leave them as they were. So you get little things like that in the paper that say that somebody must have read the book somewhere, but they won't admit it. So, yes, it is the stone in the pond with the ripples. You get lots of little things like that. And there was an article in the paper today, actually, just a small article, saying that there's a number of mayors around the country have suddenly decided to come out against amalgamation of councils because they saw absolutely no worthwhile profit in it. And there never is, because it's all about rape. It's all about taking ratepayers' money. You amalgamate councils and you just give them the people at the top a better ability to take
rape. I've decided to rename them rapes, you know.
Yeah.
Because that's all we're doing, you know. We're not ratepayers, we're ratepayers. We're just paying to be raped.
Yes, that's right. And so that's the way the system works. Every avenue, every aspect, there are people at the financial top end of the pyramid who are looking at our society and just deciding every single way that they can screw the dollar out of people. And amalgamation of councils is one of them, of course. MMP is another one, because you can completely and totally control government with MMP. You don't have democracy anymore with MMP. You have total control of government. There was something else. What was I going to say? I forgot. It's just slipped out of my brain. Oh, that's another one. The books and publishing houses. I mentioned about publishing houses before, about how all the small publishing houses have all gone. And you only have big publishing houses now, and they totally control books. Well, there's another way they control books, because when I was driving around the country with my wife selling our books, we started going around to the libraries in Taranaki and Waikato, the libraries were very enthusiastic. They bought some of our books, and then we went up to Auckland, and I went to one area in Auckland, might have been Mount Albert, I think, and we went to the library there, and the lady says, "Oh no, we're not allowed to buy books from independent authors anymore." And I said, "Oh, why is that?" And she said, "Oh, I don't know," she says, "but we've been told to you have to approach your central library in Auckland City." So I thought, maybe this might be a one-off. So we went to another library in another location, and they said exactly the same thing. And then we went to a third one, and they said the same thing. So I thought, there's no point in going to the other 55 or so libraries in Auckland. And we'll go straight to the central library in Auckland. And so we went there, and they said, our new policy is that we are only allowed to buy books from book distributing companies. And I said, "Well, who are they?" And they said, "People like Wheelers." And I said, how do I get in touch with them? And so they gave me the address, and I thought, this is a bit off, you know. There are 55 or 56 libraries in Auckland, and I can't sell a single book to them. And, there's 1.5 million people. So this guy that was telling us, he made it quite clear that the system had changed. So anyway, we went to Wheelers, and we found out that if Wheelers were going to buy our books. Now, Wheelers, book distributing companies, there are 3 or 4 or 5 major book distributing companies in New Zealand, and Wheelers are one of the big ones. Wheelers actually don't purchase books and store them, per se. What they do is they wait for a library or somebody, a bookstore, to order them. So though you get a library in Auckland, like the Central Library in Auckland, they will say, "Okay, well, we need 10 books of Stone of Akron." So instead of going to the author and getting them off the author directly and cheaper, they go to Wheelers. Wheelers will immediately put 40% on the book, minimum, because that's what Wheelers told me. I had to drop my price 40% to sell my book to Wheelers, so then they could on-sell the book to Auckland City Council. They will also put another margin, their profitable margin, on the book. So the system of control of books is absolute now in this country, in that all libraries are being targeted, and high schools. They started working their way through the high schools as well, because we started going to some high schools, and they were saying the same thing. Well, we've been told we're not allowed to buy books anymore. We have to go through book distributing companies who control sales of books and put the price up. So we found this out to be quite a major problem, because after we had canvassed the whole of New Zealand, we did a lot of driving around, my wife and I, and we went from Kaitaia all the way down to Invercargill. And we actually cannot sell our books directly to libraries in Auckland, Hamilton, Tauranga, Wellington, Lower Hutt, Dunedin, and Christchurch. So about three quarters of this country, the libraries of those cities, will not buy my books from me. They will only purchase them through a book distributing company and pay a high price for it. And what that means is that the book distributing companies and the publishing houses now have total control of the sale of books. And the same applies.
That's freaky, man.
Yeah, I know, but this is the way the system works. And this is the truth. This is what goes on. I actually wrote to the mayors and the councillors of Auckland Council and Wellington Council, and there was one councillor in Auckland and one councillor in Wellington who actually wrote back to me, and they were quite disturbed by it. And then eventually I got letters from both of the mayors saying, we are looking into it, blah, blah, blah. And then a week or two later I got a request from the city libraries of both cities saying, we would like to purchase 6 or 8 or 10 of your books to service 1.5, 1.8 million people. Only 20 books all told. So basically what they were saying to me is, shut up and go away, we'll buy a few of your books and then go away. So although I have been down to Hookatikka and put 3 of my books into Hookatikka Library, and they were very enthusiastic people down there and very nice people, and then I went around to the high school, and the Hookatikka High School also bought 3 of my books, and they were very... I've actually got 6 books in Hookatikka and about 6 books in Wellington to service their libraries. Isn't that interesting?
It's when people say the word interesting, what I hear in my head is, that's freaking nuts!
Did you know that also in our country that prides itself on racial and sexual equality, that 99% of all librarians in high schools and libraries in this country are female?
Did you say 99%?
99%. It is extremely rare to come across a male librarian. In fact, in our travels from Kai Tai down to Invercargill, we probably came across about 5 men. And I think 2 of them were only stand-ins because the female librarian was away, sick or something like that.
Why aren't they trying to get the men out of the library, you reckon?
I'll leave you to answer. That one's a really interesting question. I'll leave you to answer that one.
I don't know. I mean, I think it's kind of like in schools I've noticed as well, that very similar phenomenon, the feminizing of the teaching roles.
That's right.
Okay. And men, I think a lot of them shy away from particularly early childhood education because... they get accused of sexual stuff, and there's no defense against those kind of accusations, and they wind up getting a black reputation and can't work anywhere, and they tell everybody else, and then everybody else goes, wow, that doesn't sound like the industry for me. So the men stay away, and there's nothing but women, so there's no male role models for the children to look up to. So that's, it'll unbalance everything. It'll make the women dominant, and it'll make the men feminine.
That's right, and that's exactly what's happening in this country. One of the local schools here, I was talking to the headmaster, and it was quite interesting because I walked him into his office. I was talking to him about some other entirely irrelevant problem. And he said, you know, Ian, he says, I cannot hire male teachers. They're just not around. And now this was a few years ago. I don't know what it's like now, but a few years ago he was in despair. He says, I cannot find male teachers. I've got a couple of females teachers that are leaving, and I cannot find male, because he said the majority of the teachers on my role here, he said, are female, and we cannot get male staff because there are none around. And they're none around for exactly what you just said. It's just like if you go into the Scout and the Cub movement and all the rest of it. And there was some advertising being done on television about 2 years, 3 years, maybe 4 years ago, almost pleading. It was quite an incredible advert on TV. It was almost pleading for men to put their hands up to become rugby coaches and football coaches. So then the boys had some male role models and some coaching. But as you say, all these men have been scared away because of the sexual attacks that have been made on them by the government and the media. It's died away a lot, but in the 1990s it was quite horrendous. And there were men being accused of sexual harassment and rape and all sorts, and most of them were just purely fictitious, but men were having their reputations utterly destroyed, absolutely destroyed. There was no recovery from something like that. And the damage that was being done was so horrendous that I think even the government realized that, that they had to stop this persecution of men in these roles. And while there's certainly and obviously a problem of child molestation in this country, it has been handled horrendously by the government, by idiots, pure idiots, who think they know what they're doing and have absolutely no idea. But the damage has already been done, and the result of it is that there's a great paucity now of male teachers in our schools. And 99% of all librarians in New Zealand are women. There are no male influences anyway. Interesting.
It's strange. And I think this whole male warrior spirit, you know, I think the New World Order figured out, I think having people around that actually like fighting against oppression and scumbaggery might not be a very great idea. Let's wipe it out. Well, how do we do that? Oh, well, how about we get the CIA to finance feminism and the Rockefeller Foundation? Oh, that sounds like a brilliant idea. Oh, yeah, man, let's implement it.
Yep, that's what it's all about. Complete nutters.
You know, it's nutters based upon scumbaggery. It's like one lie leading to another, leading to another, leading to another, and you know what happens every time you catch a liar out in one lie? They have to tell 10 times as many lies as they've already told in order to lie the way out of the one lie you exposed.
That's it. John Key and John Banks know all about that.
Oh, God. I freaking hate Banksy. I hate John Key. I hate Banksy. Hate's not too strong a word, okay? People, I think, are just not in touch with their hate. They're not in touch with their rage. And in so doing, they're completely out of touch, okay? If some scumbag sells...
That's a really good statement, Vinny. I actually like that. They're not in touch with their rage. We need to have people who are willing to go out and smack somebody on the nose. And yes, okay, they'll be in court the next day and all the rest of it. We actually need to go back to this world where we actually take action like that. So the scumbags, as you call them, actually feel the pain of what they are doing. Because at the moment, they're immune to it. What they can do is that they run away. The politicians run away, the lawyers, the solicitors run away, the corporate leaders, you know, Fontana, all these people run away. They can do it. Look at the Pike River mine, for goodness sake. In the 21st century, we blow up a mine and we kill dozens of miners. And look at the mess. It should never, ever have happened. You cannot have mine explosions like that in today's society with all the technology and all the knowledge we have of safety in mines all around the world over hundreds of years of mining, and we blow up a mine. That is a government problem. And the government has dealt with it exceptionally poorly.
The first police officer on the scene was really shocked that he wasn't the first person on the scene after the accident. You know who was?
No.
The New Zealand Army. Specifically, the New Zealand Army demolitions people.
Oh, really? Hmm. Well, that's a new one on me.
Yeah, and around the time there was a big debate about whether or not they should have open cast mines and whether or not the ones where they're going underground and everything were a bit too dangerous because they wanted to open up all the national parks for mining. And guess what happened directly after this underground explosion? Ah, you know what? Maybe open cast mining isn't such a bad thing after all. Are you sure you're just saying that, Mr. Key? It's not because you got shares in Jackson Mining, is it? No, nothing to do with that. I'm not corrupt. I never accused you of being corrupt. Yeah, well, you were gonna.
You're full of interesting facts.
Oh, yeah. I retain bits and pieces here or there. Like, you know how the media's adept at coming up with sound bites that mean nothing?
Yep.
I'm adept at remembering sound bites that actually mean something. Unfortunately, sometimes they're out of context and don't actually make any sense, but they sound like they do.
That's one of the things about being a leader, actually, is having a very good memory, because to remember what these people have said over the years and throw it back in their faces, because they start to panic when that happens. Because they live on a daily basis of lies and bullshit. And they, as you say, you tell one lie, then you're going to have to tell another 10 on top of that. and they lose track of it. They have no memory, so they lose track of all the lies that they've said. Mm. And you can see their faces doing some phenomenal footwork.
Aerobics,
yeah. Yeah, it's just tremendous to see the muscles in their faces just dancing around like Swan Lake, you know. It's just incredible. While their brains are desperately trying to find an answer to the 10 lies that they've said. It's quite amusing at times.
Well, usually, and I think the Prime Minister is exemplary at this particular job, where he'll just start talking and rambling, not answer the question, and just keep talking and rambling. And when you say, but you have to get back to the question, he goes, next question.
Yep. No, he's been well trained.
Like a dog, you know?
Yep.
Pavlov.
He has a very good team of support staff. It's not the government, and it's not the National Party. On the outside, he must have an extremely good support party who are doing a lot of research and telling him how to speak and what to say.
He must have people working overtime, you know, like up all night, you know, putting the P back into PR. Hey, incidentally, do you know what the best thing about being on P is?
What's that?
It's only six more sleeps till Christmas.
I wouldn't know. So what makes you get out of bed in the morning, Vinny?
The missus wakes me up.
Oh, that's handy.
More or less. There's frickin' cicadas outside, and we don't have blackout curtains either. What's a more interesting question is, what makes me stay up long into the night? Exposing scumbaggery. Editing. Yeah, uploading stuff. Yeah. We can get like a 4 a.m. finish or a 5 or a 6 or sometimes 8. I remember one time I stayed up 3 nights in a row and put together 3 documentaries. 3 documentaries in 3 nights edited. Just
that's not bad.
Yeah. It's freaking brutal is what it is. I think my bedtimes were like 5:20, 6:40 and then 11 a.m.
Right.
Over those 3 nights, you know. And that was because a couple of fluoride activists and another guy who's had his stuff on the North Shore, Russell Malcolm, the Pinchgate affair. I don't know if you've heard of that, but my God, does he have a story to tell about the corruption in the council. Last time he told a story about corruption in the council, he got the entire frickin' Rodney Council, including the mayor, fired after it got investigated by the government. And this time, instead of getting fired, the corrupt people have already fully taken over the council and the super city and totally phased his ass out.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So, I don't know. Whenever I'm serving others, that's when I perform above what I normally think that I'm even capable of. Because it's like, who else is going to help these people?
If not me. This is the problem, and this is one of the issues today, is that this is one of the reasons that I wrote the book that I did on the corruption of the New Zealand legal system, while I was dealing specifically with one case and exposing these ignorant little people. The bigger, wider issue is that there are hundreds and thousands of people who are being ripped off by lawyers and solicitors every week, and they don't have the strength and the knowledge and the wherewithal to fight these people. They can't. And because the systems that the lawyers and the politicians have contrived are there to protect the lawyers and the politicians, these earthy, honest people that, you know, just simply get up today to work for their families and their children, their community, they can't do anything about it. They can't fight that kind of corruption and those sort of pieces of filth, I call them. They can't do it. So I wrote the book and distributed it, and I wrote it in such a way that while it knocked the lawyers very heavily, I had to write it so then most people could actually read it and understand it, so then they could get some value from it and try and to learn from it, and give them, and hopefully give them the strength to know that they can actually fight these pieces of filth.
Well, you just got to show people examples. I mean, I think it's like, have you ever heard of the Gordian Knot, Alexander the Great?
I have heard of it, yeah. I'm trying to remember what it's about.
All right, just quick rehash. It's about genius, this story. All right, there's a knot. It's called the Gordian Knot, and it's incidentally in a place called Gordium. All right, it's a knot made out of a rope. And it was said in legend and what have you that whoever was able to undo that knot, everybody would bow to them as king. And he'd be like the king of kings, you know, baddest ass you've ever seen. And so Alexander the Great comes up and he goes, so do you guys actually really believe that story? That if I undo this knot, that you'll all, you know, bow down to me as king? And they go, yeah. And he goes, all right then. He takes out his sword, cuts it in half, and he goes, all right, king now.
That's called lateral thinking.
Yeah, see? And that's why a lot of people don't get my jokes, is they go, oh, I don't get it. And I go, well, I'm a lateral thinker, you know, think about whatever's literal and then go to the left of it.
Yeah, we see, I mean, I've never met you in my life and I've never heard of you until a couple of weeks ago, but I understand what you're saying. The problem that we have in New Zealand and the problem that you have is the problem that Raymond and I found when we went to America is that people don't talk anymore. They have no ability to understand conversation. They have no ability to converse. So our language is being lost. The use of words, the understanding of words, the double entendres, you make a joke and some people don't get it, but other people will. There was a time when I was in the Merchant Navy, you develop such a rapport with the people that you're working with month after month that you can start laughing over the same thing and nobody's actually said a word. And that is what real society and real community is all about. I sat in a mess room once. We all came up at 10 o'clock in the morning. We sat in this mess room and we were all staring at each other because after about 4 months of telling each other the same jokes, we'd run out of things to say. And then this little Welsh guy, he came in and sat next to me and he just sat back in his chair and banged his head against the wall. And I just thought that was incredibly funny. And he did, but he didn't say anything. And then after 30 seconds, he just looked at me and just yelled at me to shut up. And with a big smile on his face, and he got up and left. And nobody else at the time could understand what was going on. But the pair of us, you know, we were so close as workmates, we understood. And I hadn't said anything, but he knew I was laughing at him, and I knew he was laughing at me. The communities that we have today, the societies we have today, nobody talks to each other. And so
I would operatively ask the question, what community, Ian?
Well, this is right. We don't have a community anymore. This is why the government wants to amalgamate everything. They want to take away communities, regional authorities. They want to take away your local post office, your local bank, your local hairdresser. Everything. They it's all amalgamated, and you answer to the massa in the big house. We're all slaves to the system now, and you're dead right. There is no community. There's no society. There's no spirit.
It's been annihilated by television.
It has. Television and computer games and Skype and what's the other one? Facebook and Twitter.
See, now the only time you can actually have a conversation with somebody is if you're having a conversation about a conversation you had on Skype.
Yes, this is it. I was listening to, what's his name, a guy I've never heard of before. He was introduced to me just a few weeks ago, a guy called London. He's a singer-songwriter here in New Zealand. He's absolutely brilliant. He's one of the best singer-songwriters I've heard in a very, very long time. And one of his songs is about dumbing down people, and his lyrics are tremendous. And there's another one where, in that dumbing down, I think, is it that one? Yeah, it is. It's in that song, Dumbing Down, where he went to work and everybody's laughing. And when he asked what they're laughing about, it's because they saw on Facebook how somebody had put a secret camera in somebody else's toilet. And that is the level of intellect and intelligence we're at today with Facebook and with our corporations, our governments, MMP, and our law society. It's dumbing down people to the point where you actually find it funny to hear about a secret camera in somebody else's toilet. How much lower can we get? Well, the answer is that we can get even lower than that. We can go out and we can murder children in this country.
I've come to a thing like goodness. There's no limits to good and there's no limits to evil. However, they both define themselves by the opposite thing. Goodness defines itself by having an abundance of restraint, what it will prevent itself, what it will not allow itself to do.
That's a good definition.
And evil is the direct opposite. It defines itself from what it will not restrain itself from doing.
Correct. That's a very good definition. Very, very good definition. The Germans summed it up. I'm not sure which one it was. If it was Himmler or Goebbels, to do with the murdering of the Jews. And he said it somewhere on the lines of, you know, you kill one Jew and there's an outrage. You kill 100 Jews and there's a fuss. You keep on killing Jews and you end up killing 5 million and nobody gives a shit. And this is the way that society works and this is the way that evil works.
I believe that was a Stalin quote, actually. It was,
was it a Stalin quote? I can't remember, but I know it was a...
It goes something like this. When you kill one, it is a tragedy. But when you kill 10 million, it is a statistic.
Yes, sir. That's the dead right. People can't grasp the enormity and the inhumanity of that. It's like they cannot grasp the inhumanity of what America did with 9/11 and the Twin Towers. What's your opinion on that before I go further?
I believe there's a hell of a lot of scumbaggery involved, and the craziest conspiracy theory that came out of the day was nine virtually unarmed people were capable of getting NORAD to stand down by a guy directed in from a cave with a laptop who was already dead, according to the CIA.
Well, when the Twin Towers came down, like everybody else, I just looked at it in just absolute horror. And, you watch it for week after week and month after month. But at the back of my mind all the time, there was something niggling at my brain, and I couldn't figure out what it was. But a few years ago, 6-7 years ago, I was actually looking at it on television and saw the plane hit. And it just struck me then that it's actually impossible to bring one of those towers down by flying a plane into it. It just can't be done. Those towers are built out of solid steel, the construction of the steel framework of the buildings. And those little planes, when they hit, and as you will well remember, when they hit, they just disappeared as the planes just fell to bits as they hit the...
It was like a pencil going through a mosquito screen. Which is incidentally what the architect said a plane would do to the overall structure of the building.
That's how they were built. The architects and the engineers that built it, that's what they designed it for an aircraft hitting it, full fuel and all the rest of it. Now, the Washington government, of course, will tell you that it was the fire and the heat from the flames and the fuel. Well, if you remember when those planes hit the buildings, there was a monumental fireball on the opposite side. 90% of the fuel would have been atomized and just exploded in a big fireball. So you had about 10% left in the building. Now, that's only a few hundred.
And every single floor was completely lined with fireproof asbestos.
Yeah.
And the year before...
The thing is with steel as well is if you try and heat up steel, it will try and get rid of that heat as fast as you're putting it into it. It's very, very difficult to for steel to lose its structural strength by heating it up. You've got to heat it up to... 500, 600, 700 degrees centigrade, and that means a sustained blast of heat. You don't get that from a little carbon fire and a bit of petrol. It's actually impossible. As an engineer, I can state quite categorically, without any word of fear or making an ass of myself, you cannot bring one of those buildings down by flying a plane into it, let alone two of them. Let alone three of them. And this is the other thing that nobody will talk about, is that third building came down like a brick shit house. It just fell down. And the government won't talk about that. And, but they will say that, it came down because of damage from the other buildings, that sort of thing. Well, it's all bullshit. Mm-hmm. And so there's no question in my mind about what happened. Those buildings were professionally destroyed. The other thing is that in 1945, if you care to Google it, and look at the history books, you'll find that in 1945, a B-25 twin-engine American bomber actually flew into the side of the Empire State Building. And, of course, all the crew were killed. I think one or two people in the building were killed. And there was a big fire in the building, and the local New York firemen went up there, and they put the fire out in 40 minutes. And the crash occurred on the Saturday, and the entire building was open for business on the Monday. So there was no worries about structural strength or the building falling down or anything like that. So it proves that even in 1945, 55 years before the Twin Towers, that you could fly a plane into a building and not bring it down. But in 2001, two buildings were brought down by two little plastic tinny airplanes. The whole thing was a setup. Now, for all the conspiracy theories in the world and for all of the arguments that can be made about all sorts of things, The one thing that people should focus on entirely and exclusively is that the American government blew up the Twin Towers and used it as an excuse to invade Iraq and Afghanistan, and they blamed it on a terrorist activity.
Well, actually, it was not just an excuse to invade countries, it was also an excuse to invade everybody's privacy.
That's it. It was the opening of the door to the word terrorism, anti-terrorism, homeland security, the entire shebang. It is a gross and obscene, inhuman act that they did. And the world needs to wake up to that. And the world has. I mean, there's an awful lot of people that know this. There's numerous people, hundreds, thousands of people around the world that are speaking out about it, especially all the architects and engineers, because if you're an engineer or an architect, you look at that and immediately you say professionally, that can't happen. Full stop. End of story.
Ironically, my uncle's an architect, and he got really, really angry and started slamming the desk and stuff. And those buildings were destroyed by planes, you know, just the cognitive dissonance, the inability to even use your own training and your own skills that you've brought up your entire life is not enough to make you accept that the government will kill its own citizens its own means and ends.
That's one of the big, what can you say, it's one of the big pluses of why the Americans thought they could get away with it, is that there will be people that just simply refuse. I mean, my mind refused to think that, and it never even crossed my mind when I first saw it happen. It's just not possible. You just wouldn't conceive that that could have been a contrived business. But it wasn't until later that I began to think about it, and it was after we toured through the state and had seen the state of America and realized that this was a country in dire straits. And then I came home to New Zealand, and I was watching a documentary thing about it, and it just suddenly dawned on me in a great big flash of light, as it were, you just can't do that. You cannot bring one of those buildings down by flying a plane into it. It just can't be done. And then if you actually look at video footage, you can actually see the detonations of the demolition charges going off as the building comes down floor by floor by floor.
Yeah. See, previously I'd never think the government would do anything bad or whatever, and now I just assume, I remember, and I've said this on the radio a number of times, I was coming in home after a day's work, and my wife shouts out to me, "Hey, Vinny, did you hear about this truck bomb that they found in Times Square?" And I go, "Oh, don't worry about it, baby, it's probably just the FBI." And it was.
I know, I'm exactly the same. It doesn't matter what goes on around the world now, the first thing I'm thinking is which government and whose government is actually behind setting that up, because it is a setup.
Yeah. I mean, I treat the government the same way the Saudi Arabians treat the Israelis, you know. Doesn't matter if a water pipe breaks in Damascus or something like that, it's an Israeli plot.
Yeah, that's the way it works. And they're quite right. I mean, the terrorism that we suffer from today is not from terrorists, it's from our own homegrown governments.
Well, in fact, interestingly, if you look up the definition of terrorism in the dictionary, Ian, you'll find that terrorism is actually a system of government whereby the government threatens and terrorizes its population in order to getting them to do what it wants.
Yeah, that sounds like... I didn't realize that was... That's a dictionary view, is it?
Yep.
Well, you see, you don't have to take it one step further and say, well, if the Americans brought down the Twin Towers, which they did, and they then invaded two sovereign states, Iraq and Afghanistan, you then have to look at our own government and say, well, why did we support America and England and send our own soldiers over there to support terrorism that was homegrown terrorism?
Yeah.
Because that's what our government has done.
Well, I guess it's probably because of the same criminal scumbaggery cabal that controls the United States, also controls New Zealand, and controls the world. So, you know, everybody has the same playbook. The exact same system exists everywhere. It's just the accents are different, or the insignias on their uniforms might be a little bit different, or something of that nature. But it's all the same kettle of shite.
It is.
You know, and it's good, though. I mean, just like I don't know, have you tried Goody Goody Gumdrops before? The ice cream, you know?
Yeah, I don't like it.
Yeah. Not many people do. I like it because it's kind of like digging, you know, through this mountains of bubblegum flavored crap in order to find the nice little juicy nuggets of sugary goodness in there that are the gumdrops within the goody goody. And I think that's not entirely dissimilar from how I choose to socialize. You know, you're just going to pile through the. There's just mountains of shit out there. Shit. Fuck's sake, get that out of the way.
Yeah. You've got to sort it all out.
It's unbelievable. You know, it's like I saw an episode of Futurama and they had these brain slugs that would infect people, like that they'd attach onto your head and just sit there and just suck off your brain energy. And yeah. One of the crew, his one died, and it goes, "What happened to it?" And it goes, "The poor little guy starved to death because the guy it was attached to was too frickin' stupid to have any more energy for it to feed off." And that's entirely how I see myself to a degree. It's just so a giant brain slug that's just starving to death amidst all this stupidity.
That's it. There's an awful lot of people that they commit suicide over it. They see absolutely no focus, no reason to live in this world because they know the absolute bullshit and the shit that surrounds them.
They have no reason to live because they think that the living have no reason.
Yep. It's a tragedy, really, and there's a lot of good people that have... walked away from this planet because of it.
Yeah. Well, I figure it like gold mining, you know, how you're panhandling. Yeah. There's all this dirt and all this sand and grit and everything like that that you got to pick up in your hand and you just keep shaking it and shaking it and shaking it. And eventually, there's enough gold there to make a living off, right? That's I think it. That's how I look at it in terms of friends and social contact and what have you. And I'm very grateful that I haven't forgotten that those pieces of gold are still there amidst the dirt, if only you would dig them out and seek them out and not try and stay at home and avoid it all.
You're full of good things to say there, Vinny. You remind me of that American guy that does that dirty jobs on TV. He went around to interview these people that were... the hunters in America would take their ducks and their geese and their swans to them and they would pluck the feathers off them. And this old lady had been doing this job for decades, most of her life, and every time she opened her mouth, she had a saying, she had a piece of wisdom to say. And after about 5 minutes, the guy that does the dirty jobs there, he said, "You know, you could make a t-shirt industry out of you because of the number of good things that you've got to say." And you remind me of her.
Oh, well, thank you. Incidentally, most of my friends are much older than I am too, and they're full of wisdom, which they impart to me, and I forget about half of it.
Ah, well, you're bound to. You're only human.
Yeah, well, you know, I haven't earned any of the knowledge that they've accumulated over their longer lives that I've had and stuff like that, and it's like, I don't know.
Well, you're not doing too badly.
I could be worse.
You could be worse.
Yeah. I certainly don't see anybody else giving all the activists in this freaking country the airtime that they deserve in order to express all their ideas and their fullness and amazing variety than I do. You know, I mean, point a stick. Tell me if there is one. They don't freaking exist.
It's extremely difficult.
Yeah.
Difficult.
So, on that note, this has actually been the first 3-hour show I've done without actually even taking a break, and I was so encapsulated by our conversation here.
No, it's been very good, Vinny. I appreciate it, and I appreciate you contacting me. I've enjoyed the conversation myself as well.
Did I say encapsulated by the conversation? I meant captivated.
Well, both are appropriate.
Yeah. All right. And so, what we're going to do now is just give a quick plug, ladies and gentlemen, if you enjoyed this conversation, if you like to see more of them and what have you, then please, for the love of Norwegian cheese, go to the VinnyEastwoodShow.com and donate or subscribe for a couple of dollars a month if you're capable of affording it. And there's a proviso on that. I don't want to see anybody ever do this. Do not donate to me unless you've got all your bills paid. All right, I'm talking about you're going to have kids fed, you got to have your rent and the power and everything. You got to be totally above water if you want to donate to the show. I'm sick and tired of all these poor-ass, broke-ass activists telling me, "Oh, Vinny, I can't give you anything." Are you kidding me, bro? You expose scumbaggery. You don't get paid. You don't even get any donations out of it, okay? Just keep doing what you're doing, all right? I'm doing what I'm doing for a very specific purpose. Because nobody else in this freaking country is doing it. That's really the only reason. Because it needs to be done. And out of moral obligation, I've given up my entire life. I wanted to be a film director. I wanted to make millions. And by lords, I could have. But I chose to expose scumbaggery instead. I chose to help all those people that are exposing scumbaggery when I can't do it myself. You know, give them a little bit of the coverage they deserve. And that way, every single time that somebody gets contacted by some douchebag media reporter, it's not like, oh, another person who's going to try and frickin' set me up! So, yes, thank you. Ian and Raymond, Pacman, can be found at stonesofakron.com. That's stonesofakron, AKRON.com. Ian, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Vinny. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening. TheVinnyEastwoodShow.com is where you can donate or subscribe to help keep this operation going. Hope you don't let me down. Thank you very much.